Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Kate Burdett. Coming up, in time for back to school, we'll hear from a pediatrician about childhood vaccines. Jay Fox will also speak with experts about advances in artificial intelligence and educational savings. Plus, Doug Petcash from Face the State will have a look at state politics. First up on Columbus Perspective.
Columbus children are exposed to thousands of germs every day through the food they eat, the air they breathe, and even the surfaces they touch. Vaccination can help strengthen their natural defenses against serious or even life-threatening diseases their immune system may not be able to fight on their own. Pediatrician Dr. Michael Malobski joins us now on Columbus Perspective to talk about the importance of childhood vaccinations and how healthcare providers can support families in navigating the information regarding immunization schedules. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm excited to be partnering with GSK to talk about childhood immunization, so thanks for having me.
It's our pleasure. What are the benefits of pediatric vaccination?
So certainly you and your audience, I'm sure, have heard about the rising measles cases across the country. I think since the beginning of April, the CDC estimates there have been probably about 1,700 confirmed cases of measles. This is a great example of how following the pediatric vaccination schedule can protect children from potentially harmful vaccine-preventable diseases, things like measles and whooping cough. If you look at the last 30 years since we've had a unified vaccine schedule, it's estimated we prevented over 500 million cases of illness and over a million deaths in children. Diseases like diphtheria, polio, and rubella that were once common and sometimes deadly have decreased so dramatically over the years because of the success and the effectiveness of the vaccine schedule in protecting against these diseases. In fact, you know, many of my patients haven't even heard of them at this point.
So as we unpack this, you know that we had a measles situation in Ohio, and it got to a point of severe level. And that's not just this year, but it was last year as well. So In what ways can we help our listening audience understand and differentiate between fact and fiction so that we can prevent the spread of these communicable diseases?
So I think first, recognizing that there's an enormous amount of information online, it can be overwhelming, and encouraging families to talk to your pediatrician first. Your pediatrician is your family's first and best resource when it comes to questions about fact versus fiction and questions around immunization. And we also know the internet is a reality, and I always direct families to specific internet resources. Specifically, the American Academy of Pediatrics has an amazing amount of information that is evidence-based, accessible, and family-friendly, and it's a great place for families to start answering some of these questions, and like you said, separating fact from fiction. But your family's pediatrician is your first and best resource.
All right, let's say that my wife and I come to you with our three-year-old son, and we say, we don't want to vaccinate our three-year-old son for any of these diseases because disease vaccinations cause autism. What do you say to us?
So there have been the lack of a link between vaccines and autism has been one of the most studied topics in pediatric medicine over the last 15 years. It has been completely and conclusively eliminated that there is a link between vaccines and autism. That being said, obviously, as a parent myself, I have seven children. I understand the fear and I understand the anxiety. It's important that this conversation is conducted with honesty and empathy, and that parents should be given as much information as you can and be willing to return and talk and answer questions whenever parents have them.
What is the danger of all of these extinct diseases coming back? And when I use the word extinct, I don't mean that they're gone for good, but they're gone to a significant level like polio. What happens if they come back and we're not vaccinating? What's the risk to the general public?
that's a great question. I think that one of the things about the success of the unified vaccine schedule that we talked about in preventing so much disease and death is that we're victims of our own success. That parents, we've forgotten what it was like to have children, healthy, previously healthy children, die of diseases that were commonplace but are no longer present at all. Diphtheria is a great example. Before a diphtheria vaccine, it would commonly kill a 250,000 children a year in this country because it would cause a massive throat infection and they would suffocate. But no one remembers that. And so the danger is that it's going to require children to absorb harm and perhaps lose many healthy children to things that are preventable before we recognize how important it is to continue and maintain the vaccine schedule the way it is.
Is there a differentiation between response to vaccines in rural areas versus urban areas? Because it seems like in Ohio, the rural areas are exacerbating the problem. Is that a fair statement?
I really can't speak to that. You know, I don't practice in a rural area, although Colorado certainly has its rural areas and parts of it. I really can't reliably tell you the differences between rural and non-rural areas in terms of the contribution to the vaccine issue.
I'm just, I'm postulating because I'm wondering if a lack of access to resources and information by being so geographically removed from major cities in Ohio, that would be Cincinnati, Cleveland, Columbus, if that could potentially be part of the problem because they're so far away and they're so isolated.
I mean, there's no question that equitable access to information and resources is an issue in this country with healthcare that we're constantly wrestling with. And there's no question that can certainly contribute.
How can parents prepare for their next doctor's visit? I know that when I was growing up, and I'm older than dirt, my mother relied on Ben Spock's book, and she used to bring it with her to the pediatrician's office.
Yes.
How do they prepare?
Dr. Spock, a classic. But nowadays, you know, the internet runs our information world. So the Centers for Disease Control and the American Academy of Pediatrics both have amazing online resources. Both organizations support on-time routine immunization and encourage parents and their providers to follow the recommended schedule and use well-child visits as opportunities for an open discussion about vaccines. As a practicing pediatrician myself, I can tell you that I welcome the opportunity to talk to parents and have empathetic and honest conversations. These are opportunities to build rapport and trust, especially around a topic that can create so much confusion.
Now, you said yourself you have seven children, right?
I do.
What are the ages?
My youngest is 16 and my oldest is 30, and we have four grandchildren.
Was there any discussion about vaccinations of the children or grandchildren, or was that just rote?
There was always a discussion, but all of my children are vaccinated, as are my grandchildren.
So if you're going to send a parent to a website that is nonpartisan and can provide medically based scientific information, what's the best website?
I recommend two always. First, the American Academy of Pediatrics has an enormous amount of evidence-based, easily accessible, parent-friendly resources on the topic of vaccinations. The second is one of the finest academic hospitals in the country and the world. The Children's Hospital of Philadelphia has something called their Vaccine Education Center, or the Vaccine Resource Center, on their website, which is extensively researched, evidence-based, and it's put out by one of the finest academic children's health centers in the world. So those are the two places I send when parents have questions about where should I go online. That's where I send families that I take care of.
Well, we want to thank pediatrician Dr. Michael Malobsky for weighing in on the vaccination debate. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's Jay Fox.
When I was growing up and needed a facial tissue, I asked for a Kleenex. Now, there's no such thing as a Kleenex. It's a brand. But because that brand is so ingrained in our brain, it's the first thing we think of when we need a facial tissue. The same can be said for search engines. We've turned a brand name into a verb. If we want to look something up, we Google it. It's estimated that over 1.7 million of us here in Central Ohio use Google every day. But Google is now far more than a search engine. It's driving technology, changing our workplaces, and defining how we live. Nick Burns is a Google technology expert. He joins us now on Columbus Perspective to talk about the latest in AI and what's happening at Google. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks so much. I'm so excited to talk about everything we announced at I.O. this week and all the many cool features and AI-powered tools that can help people simplify their lives.
We talk a lot about a phrase that is becoming very familiar called AI chatbots. But your company says we're now entering the era of AI agents. What is the difference and how will these agents change our daily lives?
That's a great question. You know, agents is just like a really fancy way of saying that the AI can now go out and do things on your behalf, only at your computer, of course. So it can't wash your dishes yet for you. But, you know, for instance, it can go out and look for open reservations at a restaurant or compare different, you know, options for you for whether you're purchasing groceries or add things to your cart for you. So a really good example that I love is, you know, agentic booking. So say you're looking to go sing karaoke with a group of friends, you can actually ask AI mode in search to check the reservations for you. And what that will do is have a number of agents kind of go out and search, you know, kick off a number of searches in the background to find the reservations that fit your criteria. And then it'll present you with all your options in a nicely formatted screen, and you just click the one you want to start the booking process.
That is so cool. I love that.
It really is. Yeah,
I'm just sitting here thinking, you know, how much time do I spend looking for a place to sing karaoke? And it's usually annoying. So good. Let the AI agent do it. You guys recently... go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, you know, it's just like you have all of these tabs open looking at different restaurants karaoke bars. And it's just like, this can just do it all for you.
Okay. Now, you guys recently announced that AI is moving towards what you call digital assembly lines, where multiple AI agents work together. You alluded to that when I asked you the first question. What does this mean for the future of our everyday jobs?
You know, I think just AI in general is just one of these great ways, assistive technologies that can help you get more done. So the way like an agent, you know, could, or multiple agents can actually work together to accomplish certain tasks, whether you're coding something you know, for me, like I have a lot of like different documents I need to compare and reformat and, you know, do things like that. So it makes it really simple to kind of take on more complex tasks. And that's all powered by our newest AI model, Gemini 3.5.
Now, another thing that I read that you just launched is Google Pix, an AI tool that lets anyone instantly edit photos and then translate text inside the images. How is this going to change how we share and create content?
That's a really great question. You know, I think we've had our Nano Banana image generation model, which I think is the best name ever for
yes, a product. Yes, it is.
And, you know, we've put it into a standalone app called Google Pix, and it really gives you kind of that extra precision for generating and editing your images. So whether you're starting for something completely fresh, you're generating a brand new image, or you just want to make small tweaks to an image that you're providing it, it just gives the user a lot more control. And this is great for everyday projects or even professional level projects. So whether you're creating a poster for your business or a party invite for your kid's birthday.
What about when you're taking old photos from the attic and you want to digitally restore them? Is that a good use for that?
Absolutely. I think that's one of the most remarkable ones as well. And you know, colorizing black and white photos. And if you want to have a little fun, you can even like, you know, change what people are wearing to maybe 80s outfits, you know, something like that.
I am not putting grandma in an 80s outfit.
Are you sure? Oh, it'd be so fun.
I don't think she'd like that. Great. She lived through the 80s and she didn't care for them. All right, let's get serious
for
a minute.
Maybe the 90s is her thing.
Well, actually, that was when she checked out. But with all this massive AI growth, there are huge concerns in the state of Ohio about privacy and data safety use. How is Google keeping this technology safe?
That's a really important question and one that we take very seriously. You know, Google has always been very committed to developing and using AI very responsibly. And from the beginning, we've always said the user should be in control of their own data. So anytime you're asking the AI to connect, you know, wanting to do something in, say, your Google Calendar or in Google Docs, it definitely asks your permission first. And any personal information that the AI is going to use, it's going to ask your permission, or you have to actually upload it. We do have personalization in AI, but that is an option that you have to opt into and give it permission to use the other information, say your past searches and things like that, to help customize and predict kind of the options that are most relevant to your interests.
Is interactive chat a part of what you will be offering? And if so, are the transcripts or recordings of that chat saved anywhere?
You mean like in the chatbot with Gemini?
Yep.
You know, so it's all saved to your profile. So it's only accessible to you. And it can, you know, when you're chatting with Gemini, if you're having a conversation, it can actually recall your past conversations with you. It's all kind of in line there. So if you, you know, one day tell Gemini, you know, I'm vegetarian, or I'm prefer vegan restaurants, or, you know, I'm allergic to shellfish. And the next time you look for a restaurant, it'll remember that information that you shared with it so that it'll customize those options for you.
All right. There are data centers where I'm at in Columbus, also in a town called Lancaster and New Albany, northeast of Columbus, and there are more proposed statewide. What can Google do to satisfy the environmental and energy usage concerns expressed by outraged Ohio citizens?
You know, unfortunately, I'm not the best person to talk about that one, just because I don't work in the data center area of the business. But I can tell you that, you know, we're very interested in sustainability, and we do everything we can to support the environment. And we actually use AI to manage things like our power and everything like that in kind of very new and innovative ways.
So looking ahead, how close are we to having a truly personal AI assistant that can seamlessly manage our entire day?
That's a really good, you know, we're getting close. I mean, we have kind of a new tool that we call Gemini Spark that we just announced this week. And it's a 24/7 personal AI agent that can help you throughout your life. So specifically your digital life. It can't clean your house yet, but hopefully in a few years that can happen.
You're reading ahead on the page, because that's my next question, and I'm going to show my age. How far off are we from the fantasy world of the cartoon series The Jetsons?
I would love my own Alice robot. Let me tell you, I don't know. I wish I knew.
Is that something that you guys are actively working on in research and development?
I know that we're deeply involved in researching robotics and helpful use cases of robotics, but I don't work at that end of the business. So unfortunately, I can't really share more information.
But for example, if we were to somehow connect Google to our refrigerator, and I think the technology exists. If we're out of something, can it automatically reorder it?
It could potentially. Again, that's a use case. I don't think that Google is being integrated into refrigerators at this time, but maybe that's something that they will do in the future. Who knows? I think the possibilities are really endless. You know, it's funny, though, because I just replaced my refrigerator, and it has actual cameras inside. And I was like, "What? Why do I need cameras inside my refrigerator?"
Well, I know why. So that when you open the refrigerator at 3 a.m., it says, "Ah, ah, ah, go back to bed."
Right.
Right? All right. We want to thank Nick Burns from Google for being our guest today. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's more from Jay Fox.
Here in Columbus, an estimated 80,000 adults will have college-age kids within the next 10 years. New research shows that when it comes to saving for future education costs, adults are feeling less confident about their ability to cover those expenses as economic uncertainty continues. Now, education remains a major financial priority, trailing only retirement and home ownership, but many families are unsure where to turn for guidance. Nearly half of these adults saying they don't know what would help them feel more confident about the cost of education. Andy Esser from Edward Jones joins us now on Columbus Perspective to talk about these concerns and offer some advice. Good morning.
Good morning, Jay. Thanks for having me.
It's our pleasure, Andy. Andy, why are so many families feeling behind when it comes to saving for education?
Well, you can't fault families for feeling a little bit on the back foot, especially with a lot of global and economic events that are taking place today. And you consider that most families are trying to balance how much they should save for the future versus what they need to spend today, especially on things like gas and groceries. The good news is, though, that they're not abandoning their education savings priorities. But it is hard to find that balance when every dollar has a competing interest.
So what should people know about what's called a 529 plan, and how can they be used?
529 plans have been around for 30 years, but regrettably, even though they've had expansions to their potential uses, awareness and utilization remain stunningly low. In fact, it was a real surprise in our survey that we just conducted that of families who have younger children, only 23% are currently enrolled. And I wish that were across the board, but utilization tends to skew among people who are already highly educated and highly compensated. But the good news is 529s provide a flexible path to do regular savings that provide tax advantage growth for education goals. And it doesn't have to be for just college. Recent expansions have allowed those funds to be used for most qualified education expenses, including K through 12, online courses, community college, or even, if there are surplus balances, kickstarting a person's retirement savings by rolling that over to a Roth IRA. So the flexibility is there, and 529s help accelerate a person's savings goals.
So in today's odd and confusing and upsetting economic times, how can the families balance this savings program with their other financial priorities? How can you make it work?
Well, there are many competing priorities, be it retirement savings or home ownership. The good news is that savings doesn't happen overnight, but it does happen over time. It doesn't start usually with a savings plan. It usually starts with a conversation. Now, thankfully, most families turn to themselves for that informal guidance. But what we saw is a decline in people turning to their own family members for that conversation. We see a rise in people potentially using social media or alternative intelligence to help close that knowledge gap. But what remains are formal guidance channels with maybe qualified financial advisors who are familiar with that state-specific plan and also other options that may be available to help close the gap between where people are today and the ultimate savings goals that they have in mind for their future.
So we talked a little bit about the estimated 80,000 adults who are going to have kids entering college in 10 years or less. What advice do you have for those parents who are just getting started?
Well, the good news is they aren't going it alone. I think of my colleagues maybe in Ohio. We have 700 advisors who are working with 376,000 families. And we have those conversations every day about trying to balance those competing interests between future savings for retirement, home ownership, education savings goals to help make the most of the dollars that they do have. The good news is that it's for people who are making that start. It doesn't take much in order to get on the board and to begin to accelerate that savings to ultimately close the gap between what their costs are and what their financial preparedness is for those costs.
I meant to ask you earlier, does the 529 plan include trade schools and technical training?
It does. In fact, the uses for 529 plans has grown incredibly over the past couple of years. But oddly, that expanded use has caused a lot of misunderstanding and underutilization for those things. But thankfully, there are a lot of flexible pathways. It's not just for a four-year college degree, even though we're usually seeing that as the most popular defined route. But community college, trade schools, online programs, or even rolling over surplus balances to a Roth IRA can help make sure that every dollar counts to fulfilling educational goals.
Andy, what can children do to participate so that they have a stake in this game as well?
Surprising result of our statistics is that parents are more eager to get their child involved with those educational conversations than a college counselor. And I don't know about you, when I was 15, I barely knew what college was, let alone how to pay for it. But the good news is this helps with financial literacy so that kids aren't on the back foot when they begin their families after they've graduated from college and begin a professional career. So kids can be involved in the conversation and can help, if nothing else, illuminate the parents as to what their ultimate education ambition is. The earlier they're involved, the greater the difference that can be made.
So a dime out of every glass of lemonade sold goes into the 529 plan.
It sure can be.
All right. We want to thank Andy Esser from Edward Jones for talking about this with us today. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Now, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV, here's Doug Petcash from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV.
Tourism is a key component of the Buckeye State's economy. Living in Ohio, we know the state has a lot to offer and a lot to see. Lakes, rivers, waterfalls, caves, hiking trails, ski hills, state parks, amusement parks, sports teams, museums, theaters, the list goes on. And over the last few years, the number of visitors discovering these places has really been growing at a steady pace. The Ohio Department of Development and Tourism Ohio say in 2021, visitors spent $47 billion in Ohio. Total visitation was $219 million, with $40 million overnight stays, and tourism supported more than 400,000 jobs. Fast forward 5 years to last year, the Ohio Department of Development says visitors spent $58 billion in the state. Total visitation was up to $245 million, with $49 million overnight stays, and tourism supported nearly 450,000 jobs. One of the keys is attracting people by letting them know what the attractions are in Ohio. That's where marketing and promotions come in. Tourism Ohio has new advertisements you might see here and ads targeting nearby states. One of the agency's newest ads is called Must Be the Love. Check it out. And joining me now is State Tourism Director Sarah Wickham. Sarah, thank you for being here today. Really appreciate
your time. Thanks for having me.
So we'll get more on the marketing in just a minute. But when you look at these numbers and the continued growth, what does that tell you about the importance of tourism to the state of Ohio and its economy?
Yeah, I think that tourism is a huge driver of Ohio's economy and a really important step in a relocation journey. So it's very important for us to focus on our out-of-state markets. The out-of-state spend is about three times higher than our in-state visitors. And so for us, it's really important to reach those visitors in markets 3 to 5 hours from Ohio and show them all that Ohio has to offer. People don't know a lot about Ohio, and so it's really important that we educate them about all there is to see and do in our state.
And so let's stick with that then.
Yeah.
Which states are you targeting? Because we definitely see ads here from Kentucky and West Virginia, at least that I can think of.
Absolutely. So we target, again, 3 to 5 hour drive time. Our furthest market is Buffalo, but you can think of all the markets right around Ohio. We have a couple Michigan markets, Indiana, West Virginia, Kentucky, and Pennsylvania. So we target those large markets right around our state because we know that those are the travelers that are most likely to visit Ohio. Those travelers generally have a planning cycle of 2 weeks to 2 months. And so we have a really tight window to tell the seasonal story about all there is to do in Ohio.
Yeah, that is interesting. And so the target really is the drivable tourism dollars rather than trying to get somebody to fly here?
So primarily we focus on our drive markets, and those have really been the markets where we have spent the majority of our funds over the last handful of years. But airports across Ohio are really expanding opportunity. We're seeing every couple of months a new flight into or out of our state. And so we're looking at those markets and seeing where there might be a business case to expand to some of those fly-to markets.
How competitive is it, you know, when you look at what your office does and the, you know, similar offices in those surrounding states? They're trying to pluck us a way to go to their states.
Absolutely.
Too.
It's incredibly competitive. And I think that there is a perception that Michigan is the leader here. Pure Michigan, everyone knows it. But the data doesn't tell that same story. Ohio has more visitors than any of our surrounding states each and every year. And we have more visitor spend than all of our surrounding states except Pennsylvania.
Except Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. So when we look at those numbers, mm-hmm. you know, from like 219 million visits to 245 million, from 49 billion spent to 58 billion spent just in the last 5 years. What do you attribute the growth to?
I do think that it is the focus on the out-of-state markets. Again, those visitors come in, they spend a lot more, and we know that satisfaction is very, very high. 93% of visitors intend to return in the next 12 months. Those return visits are really bringing a lot of dollars into the state.
Is that because they want to do the same thing again, or maybe they were in Hocking Hills and they saw something nearby that they want to go check out next time?
I think that our strength is our variety. There is so much to do. We are a 12-month destination. Mm-hmm. You can come back again and again and have a new experience each and every time.
That's interesting, too. So the department says that tourism supported 447,000 jobs in 2025. So what kinds of jobs are you talking about?
Yeah, so those jobs include those that are directly tourism related, those at our convention and visitors bureaus, those that work in restaurants and at attractions. Some of it's retail, but we look really closely at the data to understand how those numbers work. You know, To think about how this impacts some of our small towns, for example, mm-hmm. I saw a press release yesterday from Logan County. They claim $221 million of economic impact in Logan County in 2025. That's huge. Logan
Just
County is, yes, tourism. Bell Fountain, Indian Lake, $221 million of economic impact. It's a really big deal.
You know, and especially for that area when you think about Indian Lake, too. The
Absolutely.
Tornadoes just two or three mm-hmm. years ago, to hear that they're rebounding to that amount is a great story for them.
Yes, yeah.
So the state also recently announced a new partnership with the convention, or I'm sorry, yeah, the Greater Columbus Convention Center.
Yes.
How will it work? What's the aim there?
Yeah, so we wanted to help visitors to the convention center to tie Columbus to the greater state. You know, I know when I go and travel for conventions, I tend to see very few things outside of the convention center and the area right around it. But we know yeah. that having those visitors, more than a million of them every year in our state, is a huge opportunity. So we want to help them see that Ohio is just as cool as Columbus is. So we've introduced a lot of big graphics and branding, targeted digital messaging for each conference that comes to town, and helping those visitors to really make that connection.
And you know, tax dollars pay for things like, you know, those graphics and the messaging, the advertising that you're seeing mm-hmm. in other states and whatnot. Do you believe that that is a good return on investment for what the people of Ohio are putting into the tourism industry here?
I absolutely do. You know, we conduct return on investment data, return on investment research each and every year to understand the impact that our advertising is having. And it really tells a very clear story about how well those dollars are inducing people to travel. Our research breaks down the travelers that would have come anyway and those that saw our ads and made a trip as a result. So I absolutely think that it is a wonderful investment for the state.
And when you look at the numbers over the last 5 years or so, how do you come up with those numbers? How do you know $58 billion was spent and there were 245 million visits?
Yeah, so we work with very qualified research firms to give us that information. You know, for example, Tourism Economics pulls data both from Ohio and from credit card companies, airlines, all different places to get that data and really do the math to tell us how we're doing. And they do it for states across the country, so it's really easy to compare how we're doing versus how our competitors are doing.
So people are already talking about getting ready to go back to school.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you've had your summer advertising campaign. Now we're just heading into August, and so what's the focus now at Tourism Ohio as we head into that next season?
Yeah, so we're closing out our fairs and festivals from the summer. The Ohio State Fair starts next week.
Yes,
everyone's very excited. But we know that fall is great for agritourism, really getting people out onto our farms across the state for pumpkin picking, apple picking, corn mazes.
Foliage.
Ohio rates really, really high across the country for fall color, which people love. It's something that we take for granted here in Ohio, but our friends in the Southeast have no experience with. So we're going to send them a little message about how great fall is here in Ohio.
I can say this, even the boring drive on I-70 across the state can be pretty good when the colors are in.
It's kind of beautiful, isn't it?
It really
is.
Well, Sarah, thank you so much for your time and for, you know, laying out how important tourism is here for the state. Appreciate
it.
A recent report shows the Social Security Trust Fund could become insolvent in just 6 years and would mean sweeping benefit cuts. That's unless Congress takes action. The urgency of the situation has brought together two senators with mostly polar opposite political beliefs. Ohio Republican Senator Bernie Moreno and Massachusetts Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren seem like very unlikely partners. In a recent New York Times op-ed, they say they don't agree on everything, but they do agree Congress has to do something now to save Social Security for future generations.
Tom Crawford doesn't worry much about his Social Security benefits.
Yeah, I worry about it more for my kids than ourselves. I think they'll probably keep it funded through my lifetime.
33-year-old Alex Lerma is thinking decades ahead.
I'm newly engaged and, you know, plan to be married soon and want to have kids and all that. And, you know, if I don't have it, you know, what's going to happen with my kids, you know?
Leaders in Washington are thinking 6 years ahead. The Social Security Advisory Board estimates the program's trust fund will become insolvent in 2032, leading to an across-the-board 22% benefit cut unless Congress acts before then.
We would put millions of seniors into poverty.
Ohio Senator Bernie Moreno recently joined with Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren in a New York Times op-ed calling for the Social Security payroll tax cap to be lifted. Right now, employees and employers pay 6.2% Social Security payroll tax on up to $184,500 of income. Earned income above that threshold is exempt from the tax.
Somebody who makes $1 million a year, good for them that they become successful. They pay 1.2% of their wages into Social Security. It's a very regressive tax.
Cedarville University economics professor Jared Pinson says lifting the cap alone could protect Social Security for another generation.
Would solve about 67% of the shortfall over the next 75 years, which would push the exhaustion date of Social Security Trust Fund to somewhere around 2050 to 2055.
Congress can't continue to kick this down the road.
AARP Ohio State Director Jenny Carlson says the Moreno-Warren proposal is promising. She says in a recent AARP Ohio survey, 55% said they will depend on Social Security for their retirement.
It is a top-of-mind issue. AARP has been the fierce defender to make sure that Social Security, if you paid into it, you're going to receive it.
Senator Moreno says the urgency of the Social Security situation brought him and Warren together.
It doesn't matter that we disagree on virtually everything else. It means it sends a signal to my colleagues that we have to get serious about solving this problem.
We also reached out to Senator Elizabeth Warren's office for an interview, but did not hear back. Senator Moreno says the proposal to lift the payroll tax cap is just one approach and will likely be part of a larger piece of legislation to protect Social Security.
I think we can fix that while at the same time lowering top marginal rates, using tariff revenue to bridge the gap in Social Security, moving to a more private option where people coming into the workforce can have that money go into an actual fund that you can track and you can own. That's the type of program that long term I think can happen, but we got to look at the totality of what we can do. There's also an idea of creating a national sovereign wealth fund. fund that would allow the government to invest in funds and use the difference between our cost of borrowing and the returns on these funds to fund Social Security, to make certain that it's there for the people who need it, who counted on it, while providing a private option if that's what people sought. So this is a comprehensive solution. It was never intended to say this is the only thing that we would do.
When I talked with Cedarville University economics professor Jared Pinson, he explained more in depth how Social Security got into this predicament of facing insolvency in 6 years.
What shocks a lot of people is that this is not an unknown problem. This has been something that has been known for a while. The only thing that has moved is the solvency date, or the exhaustion date, I should say that, because if you look at reports about 20 years ago, the exhaustion date was in the mid-2040s, but that really started to change after the 2007-2009 recession, which lowered fertility quite substantially and then was significant effect on the economy. And so that started pushing that date closer to the date that we have now.
And again, that date is 2032. Jenny Carlson with AARP Ohio says 1 in 5 people in Ohio are receiving Social Security benefits, and that number will continue to grow because Ohio has an aging population. And of course, we will continue to follow the latest developments on the proposal by Senators Marino and Warren and other new developments impacting Social Security.
Again, that's courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV. From the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV. This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. Heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS FM 97.1 The Fan and on 1460 AM The Fan 2.